This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. On February 11, the federal court decided on the protracted child custody case involving Iswan Abdullah and Deepa Subramaniam. After interviewing both children separately in chambers, Justice Tan Sri Rao Sharif, in a unanimous decision, awarded Iswan custody of the son and Deepa custody of the daughter. Explaining how this ruling will affect custodial disputes going forward is Shamila Sekran, a lawyer, as well as director of Voice of the Children, a child advocacy group. Welcome to the show, Shamila.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
Firstly, what did you think of the decision by the court?
Well, at first instance, I think it was an excellent decision. I have to say that it was it reaffirmed past decisions, so it was not anything novel or precedent-setting in that sense. But certainly, there are a number of cases like this, you know, child conversion cases, and therefore resulting in custody battles. And I think, hopefully, this decision would put to rest all those decisions or issues.
Will there be any, you know, can you foresee sort of future cases kind of looking back to this one and saying, well, based on this, now we can do this? Did it set a precedent of any kind?
Well, definitely, you know, moving forward, certainly the, you know, we have to remember that the federal court is the apex court. This is the highest court of the land. And all courts, regardless, come under the federal court. So all courts or all federal court decisions are binding on the lower courts, including the Sharia court. So the Sharia court goes up to the appellate court, Court of Appeal, but all constitutional issues must be decided by the federal court. So in that sense, I'm hoping that this will resolve a lot of the outstanding issues and that both the Sharia and the civil courts will appreciate where their jurisdictions lie and why it is their jurisdictions lie as such, so that we don't have this conundrum constantly.
On that note, the federal court in this ruling set aside the High Court decision, which was guided by the Child Act 2001. What did this ruling tell us about how the Child Act should be interpreted in custody disputes?
Well, you know, I think the first thing we have to go back to is the fact that the Child Act is the paramount act relating to children and our treatment of them and our care of them. So when we talk about issues in relating to children, any kind of issue relating to children, the basis must be read in line with the principles set out in the Child Act. That, of course, in the situation of custody disputes, must be read with the Law Reform Act, the 1976 Act, which governs both the dissolution of marriages as well as custody disputes, custody issues, and ancillary orders, basically. You know, so it's maintenance, it's custody, things like that. So I think what we need to look at is what decision the federal court made and why, the reasons behind it, to ascertain whether or not the Child Act was actually set aside. The High Court decision was set aside.
Looking at the process of how this went through, the kids were interviewed in the Chief Justice's chambers for 40 minutes separately. That sounds like a short time to talk to somebody, but is this a common practice?
Interviewing children in custody disputes, but generally, is not uncommon. Different countries, you know, it's something which is done internationally. A lot of countries of the world, a lot of Commonwealth countries are doing it. And it is viewed to be the right thing to do, to get the child's views and opinions on ultimately where their fate lies, so to speak. But, you know, the thing that troubles me about this, you know, scenario was, if you think that the federal court is made up of five elderly gentlemen, all wearing very serious black and white garbs, attire, and you've got these, you know, young kids being brought in to meet with them, I just wonder how these children had felt and were feeling at the time. And I have questions about whether 40 minutes is enough. Obviously, I don't think it was. Obviously, I don't think that they should have been taken into chambers. You know, no doubt these elderly gentlemen, because they're federal court judges, are fathers and grandfathers in their own right and have a lot of experience perhaps in interacting and dealing with children, invariably your own children or their own grandchildren. And there's a huge difference between interacting with children who already know you and children who've been brought in to meet with you under certain circumstances. What kinds of issues were kind of in these children's minds? What do they think? What do they feel? Do they know where they were? You know, and it's all well and good saying, oh, you know, I don't know what happened in chambers at all. But even if you go down to say things like, you know, grandpa, you know, referring to himself as uncle or grandpa, whatever it is, you know, don't need to be afraid and things like that. I've seen adults in court doing mediation. So, you know, really it is a situation of trying to achieve an amicable settlement between two warring parties. And the judge is trying to assist both sides to come to that agreement. Even then, I see adults kind of hold back and, you know, quake. The way they talk to me outside the judge's chambers and then when they come in to chambers is very different. You know, their demeanor is different, the language they use is different. They're not so kind of forward. How much more with children who are totally confused? And if you know what this is about, that ultimately you are going to decide or say that I prefer to live with one parent over another, what exactly is going on in that child's mind?
So in ideal circumstances then, you know, because there's no doubting, as you say, that it's best to, we are talking to the people who are going to be most affected. Their views need to be factored in. So of course you need to be talking to the children.
Right.
But never mind judges. For a lot of adults, talking to children can be a difficult thing. You know, people just don't know how to talk to kids.
And kids don't know how to relate to adults sometimes.
Exactly.
You know, adults are not part of the family.
Exactly. Yeah. So what would be, you know, sort of the ideal circumstance? What would you like to see? What would be the best configuration for children to be able to speak their truth and to be comfortable doing so?
Well, you know, we have increasingly moved towards creating safe spaces for children to be interviewed in. It is not a pleasant situation to find oneself in. And I think what courts, judges, NGOs have all tried to do is work together towards making an environment, a safe environment, a kind of happier and distracting from, you know, what the issue really is, environment for the child, so that these children are able to perhaps relax a little bit and hopefully thereby we can elicit the real truth and really how they feel. But, you know, unfortunately, judges are so busy. And in particular, when you talk about High Court, Court of Appeal, Federal Court judges, I mean, even magistrates, you know, they're churning out cases. They're seeing tens and almost hundreds of cases. It's very hard for them to be totally focused on getting the right techniques, you know. And if you think that, you know, the federal court in particular rarely deals with issues involving children. So are these judges trained sufficiently and aware sufficiently to be able to interview children? Perhaps the best thing or the right thing should be for these for there to be someone who is trained and equipped to interview children present, such as a child psychologist or, you know, social workers dealing with children, welfare officers dealing with children, who know and understand and have had an opportunity to build up a little bit of a relationship with these children to be able to then, you know, kind of make them more comfortable in a particular setting so that the judges can then interview them. I can tell you that I've interviewed children. I've just gone in for the purpose of interviewing, and I often go with someone who already knows the child. And even I have a problem coming out, getting the truth from the child. You know, the child often tells you what they think you want them to say, or they think you want to know. They try to give you what you want, which isn't necessarily what is right or best for the child. So we need techniques, and there are techniques available, to be able to elicit really, ultimately, what the child really thinks and feels of a situation. So, for example, you know, both these children, whether we call them by their Muslim names or their Hindu names, both these children, were they asked what they thought of their parents' separation, of that, you know, the whole thing needs to be discussed. And really, 40 minutes to get to know the child, make them comfortable, talk to them about a whole bunch of things so that you are able then to assess whether the child actually knows and understands the ultimate questions that you are trying to ask them, because that's where your focus must be. But you need to know and assess whether the child understands the consequences of the decision, of the answers they're giving. You know, all that has to be established before you actually get to those final questions.
Also, I would guess to get a sense of what it is when a child is, you know, just really being honest with you versus when a child is giving you a people-pleasing answer versus when a child is giving you an answer where they feel a bit pressured. You need time to kind of ask different questions to gain a sense of
absolutely
how this child speaks, right?
Absolutely. You know, and often just one interview is not enough, because it's not enough to establish that relationship or to really know the child.
With the time constraints being placed on judges, though, as you mentioned, can it be a priority? I mean, considering the amount of cases and the amount of time that it would take to get to know an individual child or an individual family for this one case.
Absolutely. You know, that is one of the big problems for the courts. Generally, high court judges have a little bit more opportunity to discover and build a relationship because of the way cases run. And there may be a little bit more opportunity, not that much, you know, not really sufficient, but we have to be realistic about this whole process as well. For them to at least meet the children or child more than once, and certainly for more than half an hour, 40 minutes. There is absolutely no reason why courts cannot rely on independent third parties. Like I said, child psychologists are perfect people to do the assessment. It's not about assessing the mental ability of the child, but just getting the child to, basically come out with the truth and you know, draw pictures and, you know, things like that, or write stories about what they think about something. And you can actually gauge a lot from that.
I'm speaking today with Shamila Sekrin, a lawyer and director of Voice of the Children, which is a child advocacy group. We're talking about the federal court's decision and ruling on the protracted child custody case involving Izwan Abdullah and Deepa Subramaniam, as well as, just child custody as a whole. Up next, we find out more about how to respect the wishes of the children, as well as whether it's always better to keep siblings together when parents split. I'm quite curious about that. You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. I'm with me, Shamila Sekaran, lawyer and director of Voice of the Children, a child advocacy group. We're talking about child custody and specifically the recent federal court ruling on child custody. And now a clarification, really. A careful listener or an attentive listener, Joanne Leong, tweeted to say that I mentioned something misleading, or I misquoted a fact, that the court did not decide on custody based on the Child Act. The Child Act was referred to for the recovery order appeal. Shamila, what does that mean exactly? I clearly got my facts wrong. How does that impact the question that I asked and the whole situation?
Okay. Basically, the federal court decision, the federal court was asked to consider three different points. One was the issue of the jurisdiction of the courts, in terms of the competing court orders for the Sharia and civil court. But as a result of the High Court, the civil High Court, giving custody of both children to the mother then asked the police to recover the child from the father, the little boy from the father. And the IGP basically declined to do so, citing the two conflicting court orders. And that recovery order comes in under the Child Act, to recover the child from someone who's removed the child from where the child should be.
Which is separate from the High Court decision and the federal court ruling, which is what we're talking about.
Well, the recovery order was also part of that, because what the mother had asked the federal court to consider is whether the IGP should have then acted on the High Court decision, granting her custody and thereby recovering the boy from the father.
Coming back to what we were talking about before we went for that break, while we're talking about talking to children, trying to understand what it is that is in their best interests, is it always better to keep siblings together when parents split? I'm curious about that, because this ruling basically grants, to basically separates the siblings in some ways.
Sure. And there's no easy answer to that. The courts really need to consider all the facts before it. And it's important for both the parties, husband and wife, as well as the lawyers, to present all the facts to the court so that the court is able to make the best and the right decision. For example, if you have a situation where it's very clear that a parent favours one child and neglects another child. So, I don't know, in a situation where, for example, they think the son is king and the daughter's neglected and not looked after or not nurtured, then you may not... you may not want to give the daughter to the parent who's neglecting her or is likely to neglect her. So under those circumstances, you may end up separating children because conversely, the parent who loves the daughter may not love the son. You may have situations like that where parents show favoritism towards one gender child over another, or the older child over the younger child, or vice versa. You may have situations like that. So you may have to separate the children. But other than that, there is absolutely, it's always best to keep children together because, we have to remember that at the end of the day, your family is the one that stands with you. And that's what you want to always try and keep and maintain and promote. Family unity and oneness within a family. So when you start separating children, you have a real problem because they grow up with completely different kind of, in a completely different environment, different experiences. There's no opportunity to share. In this particular case, I understand that, the children will probably meet once in 2 months. That's hardly enough time, and over a weekend perhaps, that's hardly enough time for them to bond as siblings, so effectively they're growing up as only children.
When we come to that point then about children being asked to choose, that horrific nightmare scenario that I think a lot of us have, have pictured before when you're worried about your parents, should children be made to choose? I mean, it sounds to me as if there are just so many different things that need to be factored in when you're trying to decide what is the best, absolute best decision for a child.
Sure. And I don't think it's right ever to ask certainly younger children, who would you like to live with, mummy or daddy? I really don't think that's the right question at all. But in determining issues of which parent the child should be with, there are questions that can be asked, such as who does what with you? Like, who takes you to school? What do you think about that? Oh, mummy always takes me to school. Okay. Do you like it when mummy takes you to school? What about if daddy takes you to school? Would that make a difference? You get information like that, and the kid says, no, it's really boring when daddy takes me to school because, he just has the music on, he doesn't talk to me, whereas mummy always talks to me when she takes me to school. So you start developing, and, I don't mean to kind of like promote mothers over fathers in making that statement. I'm just suggesting, I know my brother-in-law takes my nephew to school and they have long chats on the way to school and competitions between father and son and, things like that. And I know my nephew loves it when my brother-in-law takes him to school. But I'm just, giving that as an example that, you have that situation where you're able to then ask various questions, which then enable you as the deciding authority, the judge, to then come, hopefully, to the right decision.
How do you assess the maturity of a child when it comes to asking them these sorts of questions? Because what if, you have a kid who's just going to be interested in staying with dad because dad's always...
PlayStation.
Yes, exactly. Dad's always the one who brings the toys. Dad takes me to McDonald's, And again, not that I'm saying fathers are necessarily toy givers and fast food eaters. But, what if you just have that dynamic? One is the fun parent and one is the responsible parent. And so when you leave it to the child, and their mentality of still, the world should be fun,
Well, you see, this is it. That's why you never ask the child this question, that direct question. You always ask questions around. And as, in deciding, there must be certain guidelines that, for example, within one's mind as a judge, that it's important for the child to have a good education, a solid education, formal education, it's important for the child to have a good kind of informal education, you know, the nurturing, the social skills, things like that. It's important for children to study and pass their exams. It's also important for them to have a social life and extra activities. So in asking these questions, that is what needs to be elicited from the child. If mum is all about the discipline, making sure you, you know, follow a timetable, otherwise you get punished, you know, no going to friends' houses because she's worried about you, you know, that kind of stuff, then, you know, there needs to be this middle ground, and maybe questions need to be asked as to whether there's another alternative. Yeah. And if it's, if the father's all about the fun, then that may not be too good either, because the kid may not be passing exams at the end of the day.
Coming back to this particular case, another matter is the religion of the child under Deepa's care, Nurul Nabila. What did the court say about the status of her religion?
I don't think the court made a pronouncement, certainly not the federal court, made a pronouncement on the religion. It's interesting because the federal court seemed to refer to the boy by his Muslim name, and certainly that's what the court, I think it was said in the judgment, that he, in chambers, the boy introduced himself with his Muslim name, and the girl was referred to by her Hindu name. So that's interesting. Have the children decided on their own religion in doing so? I don't know, but the court did not make a pronouncement on that, which is one of the big issues now.
Yes, and with a custody order, is the custodial parent free to determine the religious instruction of the child? Because we've spoken to, I think, Fariazat recently about how, in his view, children should be the ones who determine their religion. You know, in many ways, it should not necessarily be that of a parent or a caregiver to sort of impose your religion upon your child. That should be up to the child. But by the law, is that correct?
Okay. Let me just say, I agree in some part with Fari, who's a very, very dear friend, but I don't agree in total, because you need to teach religion to a child from young. If a child has no concept and knowledge of God growing up, it's not something you suddenly acquire overnight. So the natural thing is for a parent, if a parent has a religion, would be to impart knowledge of that religion. But I do agree that at some point in that child's life, that child will then choose whether they're going to continue practicing the faith, the religion of their parents, and developing their own relationship with God at that point, or whether they're going to go off in a different direction. And I think, you know, that is fair, that they should be allowed to do whatever they want to do at the appropriate time. But one needs to kind of give a certain amount of instruction and nurturing, which would be religious-based.
Direction, I suppose.
Exactly. But in this scenario, asking about the law, well, you see, this is it. The problem with a lot of the laws that we have governing us on this issue is that there is very little practical applicability. You know, the law exists in the written word, but when we translate it into human lives, can it be applied? And can it be applied without much issue? And I think that is where our big problem is, because when you give a Hindu mother, in this case, a Hindu mother custody of technically a Muslim child, what happens, right? I mean, she's going to be instructing the child in her own religion.
Precisely. And can she get in trouble for that? I mean, is that something that she could run against the law when it comes to that sort of behavior?
Okay, the first thing we have to remember is that Sharia law is state enacted. There's no federal Sharia system, unlike the civil law system, which is a federal, all the laws are federally enacted, if you know what I mean. So I think one would have to look at the various state enactments, and I do believe that almost all of them do have some element of basically not proselytizing or not converting a Muslim and not doing anything to cause a Muslim to deviate from his or her path. So I believe that Deepa, the mother in this case, comes from Negeri Sembilan, and I believe the Negeri Sembilan enactment has words to that effect. So technically she could get into trouble.
Even if it's not where she lives?
If I'm not mistaken, I think this enactment all talks about people who are of that state. So it may include her. I think we would have to look at the law specifically. But a general statement would be she could get into trouble.
And if she were to try to challenge this law, would she be doing so in a civil or a Sharia court?
That's a very good question. You see, it's a Sharia enactment, so technically it would be in the Sharia court. But
which would not recognize her.
Which she cannot go to the Sharia court because she's not a Muslim. So yeah, this is what I mean about, you know, the law needing to have practical applicability. And, you know, if I can quote Charles Dickens, that when it doesn't, then the law is an ass.
Former Law Minister Datuk Sri Nasri Aziz said in 2009 that the cabinet decided that children should be raised in the common religion at the time of marriage should one of their parents convert. Does this directive carry any legal influence?
No, not at all. But I think it is certainly persuasive. It's certainly something that could be raised as a persuasive argument that at that time, you're right, he was Minister of Law. And if the Minister of Law, having consulted cabinet, feels a particular way, then maybe that is the route that the country needs to go in and take. But, you know, do we even need a minister to say something like this? It makes complete sense, you know, that in this case, as in many other cases like this, you have a situation where the conversion was unilateral. Is that something we can and should allow? Or should it be something that both parents have an agreement over? Now, again, there are cases like this, a number of these cases, and of course Indira Gandhi's coming up as well on appeal, which is another case which is on fours with this. You have a situation where two parties got married under a particular legal system. The children were born off that marriage. I think the status quo should remain until and unless both agree to change. Now, we have to remember that marriage is a contract of sorts, you know, and like any other contract, one, you cannot change the terms of the contract unilaterally. I can't go off and, having signed an agreement with someone, go off and say, well, you know, I disagree with the payment terms. I'm not going to pay, and I'm going to come to court and say, no, you know, I've unilaterally changed it. I've changed my mind. Yeah, you can't do that. You have to still abide by that contract that was signed. And contracts do allow for variation. So until and unless it's varied, and both parties have to agree to the variation, until and unless it's varied, you have to stick with the original terms.
While we're talking about, I guess, original terms and, you know, possible moments of looking at this behavior and going, well, I don't think this is, you know, proper behavior. The federal court did not comment on how Iswan disobeyed the High Court decision in 2013, which awarded deeper custody of both children and took his son away. Overall, do you think the behavior of the father in this case was rewarded?
You know, I know a lot of people have said that, and my understanding of the federal court's decision was that they decided to give the father custody of the child based on that whole interview with the children and seemingly having considered the paramount welfare of the child, best interests of the child, you know. So they looked at all that and then decided based on this, not based on the fact that, you know, the father took the boy and therefore he can have the boy, not based on that, but based on the fact that having interviewed the boy, we think that he's best off with the father, was the reason why they gave him the child. So yes, it does seem as if the father's actions were rewarded, but at the end of the day, if the court applies the right considerations, and I think this is something we've already kind of discussed, and to my mind, whether they've done the right thing and interviewed the children the right way and come to the right conclusion, I'm in doubt. But if a court does apply the right considerations, then it can vary this, you know. But I think what the court perhaps, even in having given the father custody of the son, I think the court should have made some kind of remark. I know this was not an issue before the court. It wasn't a question posed to the federal court. But courts have been known to make obiter statements, to be, you know, which have some kind of impact on the consideration. And I think they could have and they should have.
What do you make of the suggestion from the Muslim Lawyers Association that a tribunal consisting of a civil and Sharia court judges be set up to decide similar cases going forward?
Do we need it? It's my question. If we need it, then great. I really don't see the need for it. I don't see the practical reason for it. I just think it's going to confuse matters even more. I think we should just go back to basics. You know, we don't need more laws and more tribunals and more confusion. Life is already difficult as it is. We really don't need to add to the difficulties and conflicts in life. It's very simple, you know. And, you know, it doesn't even have to be about a Muslim and non-Muslim, even among two non-Muslims, you know, a Hindu and a Buddhist or Christian or whatever it is, the same application should apply, that if one parent wants to convert a child, they need to tell the other parent and get that other parent's permission. Of course, in this country, because of the way of the prominence of Islam and the laws governing the conversion and all that kind of stuff of the, you know, the whole proceeding processes, it's a little bit harder where Islam is concerned. But I'm just saying, you know, we should just cut all this out and just go with the practical approach, which is a child born of a particular marriage, you need to decide what's going to happen to that child. And in the event of dispute, status quo remains until such time as the child is old enough to decide for him or herself.
Thank you very much for coming in, Shamila. I've been speaking with Shamila Sekharan, lawyer and director of Voice of the Children. Together we've been talking about the federal court ruling on child custody. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.